the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. He has loosed the faithful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on.
Hey, Ryan?
Hello.
Oh, hey, Ryan. Somehow I got dropped. Well, that was the Battle Hymn of the Republic we were trying to start out there with a bit. Had a momentary cutoff. Starting out a new show here with Conservative Casual Friday, your show host, Andrew Harrod. And we want to sort of set ourselves, I guess, in a conflict mood, a Civil War mood with the Battle of the Republic, where we're going to analyze the January 6th, 2021 riot. Insurrection or melee, if you want to call it, on Capitol Hill during the count of the Electoral College votes. And joining us today is Ryan Morrow, the Clarion Intelligence Network Director, to discuss this. Well, welcome to the show, Ryan.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, here at Conservative Casual Friday, we like to discuss important events of the day for conservatives and others. And so looking at these events, this really shocking sort of melee here on this past January 6th, interrupting the, apparently targeting the count of Electoral College votes by the House and in the presence of the House and the Senate in this recent presidential election. Who was involved in this Capitol building riot and break-in?
Basically, if I had to summarize it, I would say it was a terrorist attack previously organized before the rally by the outright. And some of them don't like Trump, actually. Some of them do. But ideologically, I would say they are not representative of the Republican Party or even Trump voters. But the problem is that in this clearly organized attack, it wasn't spontaneous. They correctly calculated that once they started the attack, that the most hyper-partisan conspiratorial elements within the rally, which would be people not associated with the alt-right necessarily, but are radical enough in their Trumpism that they would jump into an attack. It kind of caught up in the frenzy. And so that's kind of how the attack happened, as opposed to having a bunch of people show up at a pro-Trump rally. Trump shows up. He puts combative language in there, which I do think it fits the definition of incitement, maybe not legally, but morally and dictionary definition fits incitement. And so you can say he bears responsibility for that contributing element. But make no mistake about it, I think the evidence is clear that the most radical groups here from the alt-right were planning this for days beforehand, regardless of what was said at that rally.
And that's then evident from like social media activity, Facebook and Twitter or such?
Yes, because my team had actually provided intelligence to the authorities on a pretty consistent basis for about 2 months prior to the attack. We knew this was coming, and so did lots of law enforcement personnel, that something like this was going to happen. It was more successful and dramatic than I anticipated, because it was just it was something I feared, but it was hard to envision actually happening. But we also know from the documents from the people being arrested that they were part of specific groups whose names may be lost on some of the audience, and specific movements like QAnon, and then there are ties to Oath Keepers, Three Percenters, these other like hardcore militia types groups, and then some more white supremacist elements like the Boogaloo Boys, Holocaust deniers, and things like that for the organized elements. So you really had those two things come together, combined with the, I'm trying to say it lightly, the unfortunate response of the president when the events began that made the attack so successful.
Well, let's look at some of these groups. Who are these percenters? That's something, a group I've heard about in this recent reporting that I haven't really known before.
A lot. So, yeah, there's a lot that's been known about them because some of these groups are pretty open. And they don't all agree with each other, which is why I'm using the term alt-right for this, because I don't – like, what's the umbrella term for all this? But the Three Percenters follow this really contested statistic, arguing that the American Revolution succeeded with only the participation and support of 3% of the population. And so for a fringe group, that is very, very powerful. Because it says that your inferiority in numbers really doesn't matter. And in fact, it makes you even more like the Minutemen of the American Revolution. So you should crave being unpopular. Now, that statistic has been debunked and challenged, but you still see it out there being said by people who aren't even three percenters. And so they're kind of like an anti-government militia, similar to Oath Keepers. And you'll meet people who maybe hung out with them, and they'll be like, no, those guys aren't radical. But I've got to tell you, virtually every single time we're looking at an account that belongs to one of these militia groups, it's not like your grandfather's getting together and saying, we just want to prepare in case there's invaders into our neighborhood so our kids don't get killed. There's like this anticipation and desire for a civil war to happen and really nutty conspiracy theories that makes someone believe that basically we're at the apocalypse, everything's about to end, America's about to end, and any of us would agree that if we believe the United States is threatened with imminent destruction, violence becomes permissible. And so the ideology, as you would predict, would lead to violence and criminality.
Interesting. And so how about this other group, the Oath Keepers? Where do they? What's their sort of agenda?
So they argue it's similar to the Three Percenters in that they will argue that they are the true upholders of the Constitution. Usually it's like it's an oath to God and the Constitution as it was originally envisioned. That all sounds good, but it usually is coupled with an idea that the government is illegitimate. And so essentially what it's saying is that I am keeping the oath by not having an oath to ideas I disagree with or the government because I disagree with it. And if I comply, it's optional. But my oath is to this really original government as they believe it was. And at a certain point, they're going to fight to restore it. There's always like this prediction of a conflict that they're preparing for in all of these groups. So it'll sound innocuous until you see how it actually plays out.
Now, I guess, were these Proud Boys, were they involved in any way in this? This is a group that, you know, came up in the debates with Trump. The reporter was asking him whether the Proud Boys, the language I guess he used was stand down with S. Pollock at Breitbart said that was precisely the language that was given to him by the reporter, I guess Chris Wallace or something, in the debate, you know, asking to disassociate or denounce Proud Boys. Were they involved as well in this takeover of the Capitol building?
There were at least elements of it there. I mean, the communications were talking about it, and then there was a denial from, I believe it was Gavin McInnes, who was like the original founder of the group. I don't believe he's actually responsible for some of the violence that you see now because it's kind of spun out of his control and there's power struggles within the group. I know people who are in the Proud Boys who actually are not extremists and they don't like to punch people. It's just they see themselves as, hey, I can fight better than the people that are at a rally, a conservative rally, so if Antifa shows up, I'm going to protect them. But then you have other people with a more gang mentality that do want to fight. And so their objective is not de-escalation. It's to have a confrontation and win it and appear on the morally right side all at once. So there were elements of Proud Boys in there. Whether it was an organization as a whole, I know they've denied that. But there are splits within the group. There's been a lot of members arrested for things that would qualify as terror plots. And then, of course, assault, unnecessarily getting into fights and things like that. So it's a group of high concern for me, even if not every single member is necessarily bad. But I would say there's enough dirt there. Why would you remain in the group at this point? Why wouldn't you just form a new one and have a clean slate and not allow people like that in?
Yeah, I guess Proud Boys, from what I understand, it started out, or it had as one of its main purposes that, you know, they would go to like Berkeley, California or something when Antifa would come out there and all these, leftist rowdies, and they would try to shut down like a speech from Ann Coulter or something. And they'd be sort of out there like a kind of like a guardian angels kind of group that to provide sort of protection was sort of one of their main ideas, how they started out.
Yeah, I mean, that is one of the ideas. It also kind of started out as a joke. It was basically for Gavin McInnes fans and people that had that kind of mindset to get together and get drunk and do stupid pranks and be immature, because many of us guys still have that frat boy side of us that we don't get to express. And it did kind of start off that way. And Gavin was a very provocative comedian, and he could be very funny. But stuff changed over time. And so I think that group has to make a decision at this point and say, well, we can say we didn't mean for this to happen, but things are the way they are. Maybe it's time to disband and just have a new group, because as of right now, there's splinters forming, and some of them are explicitly anti-Semitic and will have thousands of followers on their encrypted chats that are extremely dangerous, condemning the Jews. And so look at the product of what's being produced. So that's a tougher one to diagnose. But I will say this, I don't think Proud Boys exists without Antifa. And there were actually two Antifa members, I don't know if members is the right word, but two Antifa ideologues involved in the D.C. attack. And some people were surprised by that, but I wasn't, because in the plot to kill the governor of Michigan, that was an alliance of white supremacist anti-government militias and had an Antifa member among them.
Yeah, that's interesting. In particular, it was noted that John Sullivan from Utah, who is this sort of Antifa Black Lives Matter agitator, he was involved. He was the one who filmed the killing of Ashley Babbitt. And you say there was another person involved as well. How did those people get involved?
I think what happened is that most people don't know this, but Antifa is more than just showing up and attacking conservatives at rallies and saying you're a fascist when very often they are not fascist. They are a really effective research movement. They do intelligence gathering and they dox people. They try to ruin your life, say you're a fascist so you lose your job, things like that. And they like to document things because they view that as part of the ideological war and part of their intelligence gathering. So I would expect supporters of Antifa to show up at a planned event like this that everyone's watching and be there in order to identify people, get footage. And this specific Antifa extremist, he was involved in the issue of police brutality. So he was probably going there and hoping to get footage of the cops beating back protesters and making that part of their narrative. Then he started cheering things on, instigating a bit. He didn't organize it or lead the charge or anything, but he was egging it on and saying he enjoyed it. His defense is that he was just trying to play the role so people didn't realize he wasn't one of them, which there might be some truth there, but it seemed like he genuinely liked it because Antifa members are anarchists and they do want to see the Capitol burn.
And there was another Antifa member there, you say?
Yes. I'm forgetting the exact details of that, but the one guy, Sullivan, got all the attention And then I was sorting through some of the information and disinformation, because a lot of what you're seeing on social media, if you dive into it, it's false or exaggerated. And they're saying this is an Antifa member. You look into it and it's not. There was one other individual who, where it seemed like the connections based on his online activity indicated he was at least a supporter of Antifa. I don't know that he was connected to any Antifa affiliated organization or activism chapter, but that's the side that he was on. And so these extremes, as they want to wage war against each other, and they do kill each other, they team up too. And they seem to cheer each other's success, because honestly, what's good for the white supremacists is good for Antifa, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm. It's just sort of stir up the pot and get things more extreme, bring things more to a conflict and critical mass, and get people fighting.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about
right, that's what they want? So they're open strategy, and I've got to tell you, unlike the Islamists, who I've obviously done a lot of studying on, when they talk about instituting Sharia law in America, like, that's not going to happen. The threat is with them is that the jihadist threat's going to increase and increase, and a lot of people are going to die, and society will become more dysfunctional. We'll have overseas defeats. Israel will be threatened. India will be threatened. Things like that. But the vision of the alt-left and the alt-right to spark a race war, a civil war, an armed uprising that creates anarchy, and then they can run the show or run a part of the show as the country breaks up, I don't believe that's a crazy, far-fetched objective.
Mm-hmm. And what about this other involved in the event, or theory or ideology motivating these events, was this group called QAnon? That's something I've been hearing about in recent days. What's behind all that?
So, man, QAnon has to be the most successful hoax I've seen in my entire life. It's a very cultish type movement, and a lot of good people got involved in it at first, because it appeared like this anonymous poster who purported to be a senior intelligence operative in the Trump administration was making predictions about what would happen, and once it looked like he was being accurate, as people read into these vague, almost poetic statements, he would continuously do it. And then somehow the predictions, like, oh, Hillary Clinton will be arrested on Sunday, and then it doesn't happen, people would find out, would come up with reasons why it didn't happen. And then there'd be like another post saying, I wasn't really wrong. It's not that she was arrested, but they delayed it. And it just kept going on and on. But what the QAnon theory proposed was that behind the chaos of the Trump administration and the left battling with the right is that Trump was essentially in control. What seems to be chaos is actually an organized effort to purge the country of a conspiracy of Democrats who worship Satan, traffic in child sex trafficking, drink the blood of children, all this like wild stuff. And the reason that gets so dangerous, not just like a silly conspiracy theory, is that when you believe your political adversaries are that evil and are molesting children, drinking their blood, plotting to destroy America, and your guy is going to save America, that'll lead to violence, because in that scenario, if it was true, anyone would agree it's violent and time for an uprising. And so that created a foundation for QAnon supporters believing that the great storm was about to happen and the great awakening was about to happen, meaning all the Democrats, all the bad guys were going to be locked up over 24, 48 hours. And it was going to usher in this messianic period in America led by Donald Trump. That's why they get at the rally, and when they hear Trump's words about marching on the Capitol and we need to stop this, referring to the certification of the electoral vote, in their mind, that terrorism they're engaging in is liberation, saving the children, and saving the country, and they're going to win. It's not just a terrorist attack for the sake of destroying property and hurting people. They're going to win because Q's prophecies are coming true. And so now you're reading all these meltdown stories from people, because there were just so many people that believed this, and now it's been debunked. I think the vast majority of QAnon believers would agree it's been debunked now. and they're just trying to get their senses together. And thank God for that. At least something positive can come from this mess.
Oh, wow. So the ultimate prediction of QAnon was that somehow Trump was going to be victorious. So then was the goal of this break-in, was it really then they were thinking they were going to somehow stop the Electoral College certification and then that would somehow bring Trump into power again?
Yes, and Giuliani was at the rally talking about how if we're right, they're all going to be arrested and, you know, the members of Congress and the people who rigged the election. And that all, whether Giuliani knew it or not, is what QAnon was saying would be about to happen. So if you believe in the QAnon prophecies, things are going exactly according to plan. And there is supposed to be this giant time where all the bad, your perceived bad guys, all the Democratic leaders you believe are worshiping Satan while hurting innocent children are going to be locked up, but it's going to require the uprising of the people. And so that was the moment.
Well, that's interesting. You know, QAnon was associated particularly with this Ashley Babbitt woman who was shot by a Capitol police officer as she was trying to break through a door near the Senate side of the Capitol. She apparently had been a QAnon follower. She was a 14-year Air Force veteran. I mean, that's really astonishing that some person like that in the Air Force, a veteran, could really believe in something like QAnon.
Yeah, yeah. That's what's so freaky about it. It's like if you watch these documentaries about cults on Netflix and HBO, sometimes you'll see normal people, but there's in the documentaries, they're so weird. You're like, yeah, right, you're a weird person. But a lot of the QAnon people are not outwardly off. They're not outwardly weird. They're people who have jobs, and they're people who are not dumb, and there's a lot of genuinely patriotic people involved in it who just got wrapped up in an echo chamber, and our society has not adapted to social media echo chambers yet. It's a rapidly moving, relatively new information source, and people don't know how to handle it yet. We don't know how to maintain our mental health and deal with it. And so this is really the result of it. It's just luckily whoever was behind the Q hoax put down these markers, these definitive markers, and that allowed it to be debunked. But what it tells me is that what if someone smarter and slicker comes along for QAnon round two, they come up with a new conspiracy and they know not to put those markers down. It shows the potential of these ideologies and these cultish movements to really skyrocket, because what you're seeing is extremist groups and these dangerous hoaxes having a lot of success when those guys aren't even good at what they do.
Mm-hmm. And so has anyone been able to indicate or find out who is behind QAnon yet? Is there any unmasking of that?
Yeah, it seems like almost the consensus broadly is that this fellow Watkins, Watkins, who I'm forgetting if he was in Japan now, but I know he's in the Philippines for a long time, who had a previous internet forum where Q appeared, and then that internet forum got shut down, and then a new one opened up that this same guy ran, and what do you know, Q shows up on both, and only the administrator of those forums can facilitate the postings by whoever Q is. And there's been some investigations, and there's a lot of Q merchandise out there that's actually sold, so there's a financial incentive for the hoaxer to keep this going. And then as there was more investigations into this, it turned out that Watkins is politically well-connected, right-wing activist, new Sidney Powell. And that's what's frightening, is that you took someone who had these mainstream connections, is a political operative, not just some nobody, who basically seems to have conjured this all up, if he is indeed behind the one that behind Q. And is overseas, so, like, what can you really do about it? And what else is this guy doing? Because we only know about the QAnon stuff because it's so public, and we know about some of what he's been doing as a political activist publicly, saying, you know, presenting himself as an expert witness on the so-called election fraud. So what's going on that we don't know about? What, who else is under the influence of this guy?
Well, and also, yeah, you briefly mentioned anti-Semitism. Of course, there are images that came out to – you know, one guy was wearing a Camp Auschwitz T-shirt. Another guy had a T-shirt on it that had the phrase that was later deciphered by people online. I quite understand it was 6MWE, which apparently stands for 6 million were not enough. You know, 6 million Jews during the Holocaust killed were not enough. What role did anti-Semitic groups play in this takeover?
There's a few different layers. There's the people like the Boogaloo Boys, who generally are sympathetic to neo-Nazism. I see some that I guess maybe could deny it, but generally are certainly white supremacists and have neo-Nazi ties. You have the open Nazis, like the people who you saw in the Capitol attack, who, by the way, there were no pictures of anyone confronting them and beating them up. So what's that about? Like, if you thought you were doing the right thing, but you have Nazis next to you, you got a problem. You're not on the right side. And you have the blatant Nazis, and then you also have those that hide it a little bit, but they talk about a Jewish conspiracy, the need to resist the Jews. They'll say that they don't hate all Jews, but Jews can run the world, and those are the bad Jews, and there's probably some good Jews that'll fight them. And so there's these kind of like anti-Semitic conspiracy theories out there that are kind of disguised as New World Order, martial law type conspiracies, but you dig into them and it doesn't take long to see that, oh, they start implying that Israel's behind this, it's a Jewish socialist conspiracy, and it's really all the same thing. So sometimes the anti-Semitism is more subtle, and then sometimes it's more open, but that explains why they're comfortable with each other. Because there's no reason you should be comfortable with people with neo-Nazi ties or with clothing that is pro-Auschwitz.
Yeah, indeed. You were saying that, you know, various groups involved in this takeover were some of them were sort of pro-Trump, others were anti-Trump. You say then that this was all pre-planned. So did Donald Trump really have anything to do with this whole main? This whole takeover?
You broke up a little bit, so who didn't have involvement or who didn't have responsibility?
I'm sorry. You say that you know, the various groups involved in this melee, this takeover, some of them were pro-Trump, others were sort of anti-Trump. I mean, so this whole thing didn't really have anything to do with Donald Trump. It was all pre-planned, and were they just sort of hoping to – they planned it after Trump announced his rally and take advantage of it?
It's a mixture. I would suspect that the people you would see in the videos who were moving as a single unit and clearly knew each other beforehand and had a plan seem to be from these types of militia groups and these more alt-right type groups. And that's who most of the pictures and videos of are that are really vile. So it's pre-planned before the rally. Some of them, just based on our intelligence monitoring of folks like this, some of them do feel Trump is a traitor. Some of them don't like him, but they all hate Biden more. And almost all of them still believe the election was rigged. And so they focus in on that, and they'll say, well, some of them do have an allegiance like the QAnon people to Trump. Some of them do. Others say they don't like Donald Trump, but he's the guy that's going to save America because the zero hour, the time in which there must be a civil war, is when the elections are canceled or just blatantly rigged, and so there's no nonviolent option anymore. And so there are white supremacists who don't like Donald Trump but were attracted to that idea. And so it's similar to kind of what Biden doesn't realize he's going to face, but he's going to from Antifa, where – Antifa, yeah, all right, they hate Donald Trump more than they like Biden. Some of them may be a little bit pro-democratic, But Biden has a fight on his hands, and he's going to learn soon that Antifa is more than an idea. And we're seeing it by, like, the 15 people who were arrested because of the violent plots in Portland that just happened and the other cities, because Antifa wants to overthrow Biden.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, yeah, maybe Democrats aren't for a little surprised. They didn't really, maybe they thought Antifa was sort of useful, but now things are going to go bad for them as well. Well, that brings, another issue. You know, we had these two pipe bombs. One pipe bomb left at the Democratic National Committee and another pipe bomb left at the Republican National Committee. Has any information come out as to who laid those pipe bombs?
So what's amazing is I don't believe that the suspect for that has been publicly identified. I don't even know if they have a suspect.
Mm-hmm.
Last I heard, that there was no one arrested for that. And that's
mm-hmm.
freaky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, those are, that's really dangerous there. I mean, more violence. I mean, they're really intended violence. I guess it would fit in with your line of thinking that, these groups going after the Capitol, they're just sort of, just want to blow everything up. They're kind of they're sort of like right wing anarchists or something. So they're just seeking to kind of destroy anything that's part of the establishment.
Right. So it's funny because you hear these terms about like anarchists and like fascists. But when you look at it, these groups that say they want to wage war on each other are so similar. Like it really is. The vast majority of Americans, Republicans, Democrats, and Independents are now in one box together, even if they don't realize it, against the alt-left, the alt-right, and the jihadists. Like, that's the struggle, even if we don't recognize it. And the Islamists are arguably anarchists because they want to create anarchy, just like you would see in Somalia, as a precursor to instituting Sharia law, because by offering security, that's how where Sharia law comes from, is, hey, we can restore order. From Antifa's point of view, some of them want to be permanent anarchists, where they believe there can be like almost like an anarchist civilian government. But some of them are anarchist communists, meaning they want anarchy because that will ultimately lead to the proper implementation of communism down the line. Anarchy comes first. Then you look at the white supremacists who want to create a white ethno state, or these anti-government militias that believe that they can seize the government or seize some of the states and create their own country. And what they all talk about is, hey, anarchy, even if they don't use that word, isn't so bad. That's the environment that we need. We need a race war, a civil war, but it needs to culminate in anarchy in order for us to take power and institute this vision that we have for the future of the United States, or what used to be the United States. So really, they kind of all are anarchists in some way.
Yeah, indeed. Thinking of anarchy and QAnon, the key figure with his 15 minutes of fame was this QAnon shaman from Arizona. I guess his name is John. Now, he's an interesting character. Talk about what you know about him. That was a wild guy going in there.
I saw some thread on Twitter where someone's friend like had dated him or something, was saying how wacky he was. Mm-hmm. But if you look at his social media page, there were some people at some point trying to say he was Antifa because he was at a Black Lives Matter protest. But he was actually at a counter protest. So some of the QAnon people, like he would call himself the QAnon shaman, and he was openly pro-Trump, they show up to a counter-protest to BLM, and then people who want to downplay the threat from the so-called far right, I don't even like that term, but the alt-right, they are desperate to say, well, these are actually Antifa infiltrators and instigators. And so there's this really misleading debate going on that I think hurts the country, where people are saying, well, what's the greater threat? And they fight tooth and nail and grasp at all these straws to say the right-wing threat is bigger. No, it's the Islamist threat. No, it's the left-wing threat. And what people have to realize is that they all rise because of each other. The Islamists online are constantly pointing to the white supremacists to vindicate their ideology. They're constantly pointing to our political infighting to say secular democracy isn't something that you want. And then the white supremacists are constantly digesting Antifa propaganda, and Antifa is constantly digesting white supremacist alt-right propaganda.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed. I mean, they need each other as their sort of mirror image to build each other up, to have their justification, their threat profile.
Exactly.
Yeah. That QAnon shaman guy, like, you know, he was complaining he's in prison that he only eats organic, and he was complaining that he hadn't eaten recently because, you know, the prison hadn't given him organic food and so forth. And really kind of crazy guy there. Well, you know, you talked about at your group at the Clarion Intelligence Network, you'd been monitoring all of this social media chatter and information from these groups. You know, were Washington, D.C. authorities negligent in preparing for this day? I mean, there's been a lot of comment now that, you know, they seem to treat it as just another normal day at the Capitol. They were given offers of the National Guard and other police to come there and give them reinforcement. And Mayor Muriel Bowser, Washington, D.C. mayor, refused that. So, you know, were they negligent in preparing for this?
Yeah, for sure, because this wasn't a surprise that there was going to be this big, boisterous rally that had the potential for violence because of everything going on. The intelligence stream, which was going on across the country, and I personally was involved in accumulating some of that intelligence and passing it along, was absolutely overwhelming. The fear about what was going to happen in the days leading up to the inauguration, partially based on intelligence, was all very real. That wasn't hype. There's an overwhelming amount. And obviously because of the rally, it was dramatically heightened. And that's why you saw the National Guard presence, but groups like Oath Keepers and QAnon and these others, they do have a lot of sympathy, a lot relatively, I would say, compared to like other extremist groups, but within law enforcement and the military, I'm not saying the majority or even a significant portion of them are extremists, but there's more of them than you would expect. And that is a problem, and that probably played some role in the lack of preparation. There was probably some sympathy there. I know that there's been some research into some of the security, and they're saying, oh, there are QAnon folks there. Most likely they just felt overwhelmed, but there was a really astonishing breakdown that happened that day in preparing for it that blows my mind. I can't see the logic in it at all. And then it got worse because of the request for the National Guard to come in not being granted by the president. As you watch it happen on TV and was tweeting about how bad Mike Pence is and how Mike Pence is essentially responsible for the destruction of the United States. And no wonder there are people in there talking about hanging Mike Pence during the attack. So it's really those two factors, total lack of preparation, the point that everyone involved in that preparation needs to be fired and frankly, I think, investigated. And then also just the president's lack of response, because it gave the clear impression to me that he was enjoying it.
You say, I hadn't quite followed that. So right when the rioting started to take place, there were calls to the president for him to authorize a National Guard contingent to come in, and he didn't respond.
Right. So there was a lack of response on two levels. There was, first of all, the most obvious, easiest thing to do would be to tweet saying, hey, knock it off and go home. This went on for hours and that didn't happen. And it was basically, that was stated after it was over. So that to me is the most clear cut case. Now with the National Guard not being called in, according to the various reports and the people with the governor of Maryland, and I mean, it's a strong case. There was a request for the National Guard to come in, and it was not allowed. And then at some point, Mike Pence, perhaps acting on his own, basically authorized it. And then that's how it started to happen. According to all accounts, it was Mike Pence that kind of set the wheels in motion on that when it wasn't going before.
Yeah, I remember hearing that Mike Pence and apparently the Secretary of Defense set in motion bringing in, so it was guard units from Maryland and Virginia, the neighboring states that came in. But then the president during this time, President Trump just remained out of the loop and was just kind of busy tweeting away.
Right. So we're not going to get a transcript of him saying, don't let it happen, but that was his response. I mean, don't send in the National Guard, but that was his responsibility. He surely knew about it because he was glued to the TV. I mean, he was tweeting about what was going on. We know he was watching it because he's reacting to it on Twitter. So the only conclusion you can have is that he didn't authorize it, because that's what the people involved in that decision-making process said was happening, and it would have been easy to do. So the only way that you could justify is if he was somehow so out of the loop that he essentially wasn't president, and that's just not the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I guess apparently Mariel Bowser, the mayor, Washington, D.C. mayor, she had – I guess there's some talk that she had rejected the idea of bringing in the guard beforehand, you know, sort of the same – similar response that – or they looked at sort of the similar to the criticism of bringing in the guard and extra police during the whole Antifa and Black Lives Matter protests over the summer, that, you know, they thought it was like too heavy-handed or the optics of it would be bad. I mean, it seems to me with all this violence that happened over the summer, you know, people should have been really worried about any kind of violence happening here on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, it wasn't that hard to envision, right? I mean, Antifa showed what you could do with just a handful of idiot anarchists. And then here you have a major historical event happening, like with all the conspiracy, like this really wasn't hard to figure out. So that's very discouraging for me, because I can accept the fact that you can't stop every single threat and every single terror cell and it's overwhelming, but like this is the most predictable thing on earth, that something like this was like the top threat at that time, and there were enough resources. It's really dispiriting. But that's also why you had 25,000 National Guard surrounding Joe Biden at the inauguration, which I know the optics aren't great on that, and some people were complaining about it. But deterrence does work with some of these extremists, because they want to succeed. They're not like jihadists who are just like, oh, there's a military force there, I want to die. That's a good way to die quickly. That's not how it works. And the objective is to have as minimal death and injury as possible. So, yeah, like for the inauguration, try to make it as seamless as possible and do go over and above.
Now, we're there for the inauguration, where we had all these troops and, you know, checkpoints and so forth. I mean, D.C. in its kind of own lockdown, people were making all these analogies to like war zones in Baghdad and so forth. Was there then really any sort of credible threat that something bad would happen on the inauguration day?
Yes, yeah. I mean, I certainly saw lots of people posting who were part of organized groups indicating like they were going to attend, you know, the January 6th rally. I don't know if they did or they didn't, but lots of memes saying about killing Joe Biden. And considering it's not that hard to hide a gun in your pocket, and some of the military and police forces, you just need a couple of closet sympathizers in there to make something really bad happen. I mean, even if Joe Biden wasn't assassinated, let's say a guard gets killed or there's a scuffle in the audience and he's taking the oath, that's still, from an ideological warfare standpoint, a lose for the United States, a win for the bad guys on the alt-left and alt-right, and will result in them gaining momentum. And you don't want them to gain momentum. You want to defeat them. So I was okay even with going over and above to make sure that that day was an ideological win for the United States, and not an ideological win for the anarchists.
Well, you know, you've indicated there and elsewhere, you know, issues of, are there sympathizers within government ranks to such alt-right groups and so forth. Was there then on Capitol Hill on this day, January 6th, were there any sympathizers among the police there? I mean, there was disputes over, like, some video showed, you know, like this one door was shown on video that was just kind of opened by the police inside, and you know, people just streamed in and the police just kind of stood there and let them walk into the Capitol building. Was there any evidence of anyone in the Capitol police actually sympathizing with these groups?
I forget who it was. I did see accounts going around when the names of officers started getting doxxed and released on the internet by people. People were supposedly finding that they had some level of sympathy for QAnon, maybe made a social media post. How into it they were, I don't know. Were they obsessed with it, or did they just see, oh, that's an interesting post and let's post it and then like start thinking about something else? I don't know. I think the biggest factor is just they were overwhelmed didn't feel comfortable using lethal force because there's all these regulations on when, if it's property damage, you can't use lethal force. You also don't want to shoot anyone, especially because now you're going to make the situation worse because you have a crowd of people ready for a fight. That's the police in that situation. With it, it's such an impossible situation that it makes sense in some way to just walk backwards and get out there and retreat because you're not going to win. But the real hero of the day was that black cop who just so skillfully led some of the attackers away from where the members of Congress and where Pence was as they were looking for him. I mean, the way he read the crowd and led them up the stairs away from there, realizing, hey, their eyes are fixated on me. They're going to follow me as I'm backing up, and I'm going to lead them away from that. And they're just going to walk right past the door that they should go into towards their target. Was amazing. He deserves every medal that he can get.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, that he was a Iraq War veteran from the airborne troops. Yeah, I remember hearing. Well, looking at, I guess, QAnon and the government again, you know, QAnon's come up with this recently elected representative from Georgia, Marjorie Taylor Greene. What's her involvement with QAnon been?
She's not tied to it. She's in it. Like, as in it as you could possibly be. There's video before she became a member of Congress where she's in a car. I saw it's one of the creepiest videos I've seen from a person of influence. And the most extreme QAnon people have this messianic view, not just of Q, not just of Trump, but of themselves. And they say we're essentially the chosen ones. We're the ones that have been awakened. And because we're those special ones who have been awakened and we know what the future is, don't listen to anyone else. Just pity them because they haven't been given the gift of the prophetic role that we have. And that's like the worst fringe of QAnon. And in this video, the future congresswoman is there saying all that in this very cultish, weird way, saying like, we know the truth. We know what's coming. And just staring at the camera. And man, it's creepy. I just can't believe that person is one of the deciders of the future of the country.
Yeah. I guess in thinking about who's in the government, you know, there's also a retired Air Force lieutenant colonel that is now being charged for trespass in the Capitol building. That, you know, that struck me again. Yet another veteran. Were there many veterans involved in this break-in? We talked about Ashley Babbitt, this other QAnon follower, and then there's this a lieutenant colonel from the Air Force as well. I believe from New York, who is involved.
Yes, and we do see that across the board with these extremist groups, white supremacists, not Antifa so much, but the alt-right types. You will very easily come across people, current or former military and law enforcement, and that's partially because in terms of social bonds, those people go shooting in order to relax and socialize. It's like the equivalent of going and getting a couple beers with your friends. And so that's what they do. And so they identify with that. They are genuinely patriotic, or at least believe they're patriotic. And then it becomes like a racist version of it. But the language of the alt-right, that is not burn America down. You're saving America. You're the Minutemen. Think about all the unconstitutional things the Democrats and Republicans have done. Like, they're really able to tap into that mindset for someone who's willing to die for the country and is susceptible to those ideas for whatever reason. That language is going to gravitate people who built their own identities around, hey, I'm willing to die for the United States, and I understand that it's possible that the United States is a temporary thing, that freedom is special, and you have to from time to time water it with the blood of the patriots. So that's why you're able to get some veterans in there. When people say there's many veterans, it's because we're not used to seeing them and we don't expect to see them in those groups, but it's not many. Like, it's not like there's a high percentage of veterans in law enforcement that believe this stuff. It's just there's more people in it than we, the public, would expect out of our own ignorance.
Well, thinking about what is the strength of these groups, like on the alt-right and And I guess in general of extremist groups, like what are the greatest extremist threats today? Is it, you know, you've indicated somewhat in, alluded to this before. Is it right wing? Is it left wing? Is it jihadists? Are as some are claiming, are sort of alt-right white supremacist threats growing in the United States?
I'd say that they're all growing. Right now, the jihadist threat is decreasing. But as we can see with the way ISIS sprung up, all it takes is one victory overseas by some new group and followed by a claim of divinity and blessing from Allah. And then all of a sudden, one day you weren't talking about Al-Qaeda-type terrorism, and then everyone's talking about ISIS. So that can change very, very rapidly. I would say the threat from both the alt-right and the alt-left is rapidly increasing by whatever metric you use. And even though I don't like the debate about which one poses a greater threat, especially because it can change so rapidly, I would put it this way, and it'll sound like I'm triangulating, but this is actually my analytical conclusion. When it comes to the global threat, in terms of global networks and global security, jihad is still number one by far. When it comes to actual number of plots and people being killed within the United States due to violent attacks, it would be the alt-right types. But then if you broaden out the definition of violence and terrorism to include riots and attacks on police and burning down cities, well, then the threat is coming from the alt-left. So it depends on which angle you look at the national security threat in terms of counterterrorism, whether you want to say which of those three threats is the primary threat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting – yeah, I would agree. I think a lot of evidence indicates that's sort of the distribution. I mean, particularly on a global scale, you know, the whole interrelated jihadist threats, which are indeed state-sponsored to some extent, you know, from Iran and, mm-hmm. you know, with proxies like Hezbollah and so forth. I mean, that's much more dangerous. I mean, there's no state sponsor of an alt-right terrorist threat. There's no, you know, Nazi regime out there or something like that. I guess there isn't really much state sponsorship of alt-left. Well, maybe, you know, like China or North Korea might have some sort of, you know, propaganda or linkage there. But
that's what's scary, you know?
Yeah. That's a different, there's sort of different impacts there. Well, I guess thinking internationally, this whole takeover of the Capitol, what do you think was the effect internationally of this event? Are people around the world thinking, you know, could something like this happen elsewhere in another capital, like Berlin or something? I mean, if it happened in the United States, you know, do we have to think more in France or in Japan or something about some sort of extremist group doing something?
Yeah, I think Europe is aware of the white supremacist threat, partially because, I mean, hello, World War II. So you hear a lot about the white supremacist threats there, and there have been literally plots like in Germany to take out the entire government, and they found out that there are plotters in multiple security agencies and the military, and so they're much more used to hearing about this type of thing. And all the threats are worse in Europe. But I think the effect internationally, the worst thing is – well, it's a boon for the white supremacist side, the alt-right side, which then eventually helps the alt-left. And all these groups have international networks. So that's why I hate the term domestic terrorism, because there is no domestic terrorism now. It's all international in some way. And so the effect internationally is that it's going to make these groups more cohesive globally. It's going to just spur them into action because they've seen a success now. So they're going to be more likely – more people want to be part of that success. I think ideologically the damage to the U.S. is absolutely enormous, the worst damage of my lifetime for sure, because our biggest strength is that people around the world look to the United States as the future of the world, the ideology that they hope to implement some version of in their own homes. There's lots of people willing to die for freedom, but with that is – the idea that it also brings security, because psychologically people always value security over freedom, but the United States showed that you can have both. Now it looks like you can't have either, according to the optics of what people around the world are seeing, who also get inflammatory anti-American narratives attached to them from the media outlets like Al Jazeera overseas. So this is going to be very tough damage to quantify, but it's serious. It's serious. I'm not quite sure how to change it. The U.S. is going to have to be seen as coming out of a period of division. There has to be a popular backlash against all of this political demonization that the whole world sees. And the world has to look to the United States over the next 5 to 10 years and say, that America is back. And America defeated this period of extremism and division because they're just like us. And if America could defeat it, then we can too. And then if we don't, then frankly, I think over the long term, the United States does not survive.
Well, there's been a greater talk precisely looking at government institutions and trying to combat, particularly in the Biden administration, of combating any sort of alt-right extremist efforts. Is that going to raise any dangers, particularly if you have really ideological people in the Biden administration, really leftist people implementing any such efforts? Is that going to raise any threats to conservatives that they're going to be silenced or tarred, a replay of what the Southern Poverty Law Center has done with various conservative groups of painting them as like fascists or Nazis or anything like that?
There's merit to the concern for sure, particularly those of people who have influence at think tanks that have been slandered by the Southern Poverty Law Center and other really left-wing slanderers. That's a legitimate concern. I would not say that this perception out there I keep seeing on social media that like all conservatives are going to be put into camps. Like, that's not going to happen. But the idea that the people coming into the Biden administration may hate the right so much that they cannot distinguish between genuine fascists and just your normal conservatives who mean well, that is a real threat. And so any bill or proposal that's put forward to strengthen our ability to combat what they call domestic terrorism has to be done in lockstep to show how they're going to prevent it from spreading into civil liberties and just generic conservative thought. And frankly, I would not push forward anything that says, oh, we're setting up a far right office to study the far, because that's a relative term. I could live with alt-right, but also have an alt-left office and have them work together so that they can each see the differences, so you don't have that echo chamber that you're fighting ending up within the government.
Yeah. Hello?
Yes, I can hear you.
Oh, I thought I lost you there for a moment. Well, I guess
it's okay.
in closing up here, looking at all these sort of interrelated threats and how they play upon each other, what sort of particular techniques do you think that we should, both in the government and society at large, use to counter these extremist threats?
I'd say the first thing is very aggressively do the state sponsor of terrorism designation against countries that sponsor this stuff. Have a state sponsor of extremism and hate list. So if there's a government that is promoting hate but not necessarily arming terrorists, guess what? You're getting sanctioned just the same. You're getting called out. And then domestically, yes, there's law enforcement things that we can do. Everyone immediately says, oh, more funding, more training, setting up another office that's going to duplicate a lot of what's already done. But truthfully, the best way to fight against this extremism is in how each and every single one of us talk about these issues, because that's where this all comes from. It's tempting to just blame it on a certain political party or blame it on the media, blame it on a certain white supremacist or Antifa group. I got news for you. The reason that those groups exist is because of our own rhetoric and our own conspiracy theories and us mistreating each other over political stuff and engaging in social media battles with our Facebook friends. And that's where all this comes from, because when you spread the demonization of Republicans or the demonization of Democrats, the next logical conclusion is, who's going to save me from them? Who am I going to fight alongside?
Well, okay. Those are all important words from Ryan Morrow, the Clarion Intelligence Network director, joining us here for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Harrod. And I hope our listeners will tune in next week for another episode where we'll look at issues of the day for conservatives and others. Ryan Morrow, thank you very much for joining us.
All right. Thank you so much.
All right, then. Take care.